Well, now, as part of BBC Two's African summer season, a debate on the Africa reparations movement. Trevor Phillips is in the chair to discuss whether Britain should take the radical option.
Good evening. Should British people of the present pay a price for this country's past role in the slave trade and colonialism? Tonight, the radical option puts the case for reparations to Africa to the test. Just a few days ago, it was reported that the Queen plans, in effect, to apologise to the Maori people of New Zealand for colonial injustices. The Canadians have agreed to pay reparations to the Inuit, or Eskimo people, for loss of their land and their way of life. And, of course, Germany continues to pay compensation to victims of the Holocaust. So why not Africa and the Africans? Later in the programme, we'll examine the practicalities, how reparations might be made. But first, we're going to consider the principle. Is there a moral debt that we should acknowledge? Toye Nfani-Coyote is a broadcaster on African Affairs. Here's her case for reparations.
The first object which saluted my eyes when I arrived on the coast was the sea and a slave ship, which was then riding at anchor and waiting for its cargo. These filled me with astonishment, which was soon converted to terror when I was carried on board. The white people looked and acted in so savage a manner, for I had never seen among any people such instances of brutal cruelty. One of them held me fast by the hands and laid me across, I think, the windlass and tied my feet, while the other flogged me severely. I have seen a Negro beaten till some of his bones were broken.
This is the kind of ship in which thousands of Africans were forcibly transported in the 18th century. From the early 1500s for nearly 400 years, Europeans perpetrated one of the greatest abominations in the history of the world, the transatlantic slave trade. 15 million manacled slaves were shipped to the New World, and it was on their blood, sweat, and humiliation that empire wealth was built. Today, a century later, descendants of those slaves are still feeling the effects of that brutality.
Slavery has to be seen as a Holocaust. It's not just a mere transitory experience that we can afford to gloss over as yet another incident in human history. It's a Holocaust as far as the African peoples are concerned. It's devastating. It was devastating and remains, still is devastating.
The transatlantic slave trade began because Europeans needed workers for their newfound colonies in the Caribbean and the Americas. The local populations were decimated by violent atrocities and European diseases, and the plantation owners looked to West Africa as the nearest source of cheap labor. Africa, at the time of the first slave raids, was a continent of sophisticated societies with large, well-run cities like Benin. Some countries sent ambassadors to Europe. Parts of Africa were highly advanced technologically and skilled in the use of metals. Conditions on board were brutal, inhumane, and foul. 500 to 600 Africans were chained below deck. And as you can imagine, with soaring temperatures and no sanitation, disease was rife.
The closeness of the place and the heat of the climate added to the number in the ship, which was so crowded that each had scarcely room to turn himself, almost suffocated us. This produced copious perspiration, so that the air soon became unfit for respiration from a variety of loathsome smells and brought on a sickness amongst the slaves, of which many died.
slaves were crammed onto racks like these with hardly any headroom. And during the 51-day voyage, anything from a quarter to half of them perished. On arrival, the slaves were seasoned, a concerted effort to break their will and any ties to their past. Families were split, names were changed, and they were forbidden to speak their own languages. And lest anyone should forget, new ownership was stamped into their flesh. The slave trade was greatly assisted by the collusion of some African chieftains. Europeans found that providing guns to Africans meant they could dispense with raiding parties. Africans would start wars with their neighbors solely to capture slaves for the plantations.
I'll be so glad when the sun goes down. I'll be so glad when...
Slaves working in the plantation system were really what we call chattel slaves, which meant that they had no rights, and that was taken even as far as any offspring, any children, was deemed to belong to the owner, so that they had no lives of their own. They could be moved from one place to another without any consultation. They could be punished at will, and they could be killed in the ultimate without any legal sanction, or with very little legal sanction.
By the end of the 18th century, Britain had become the centre of the slave trade, and Liverpool was the key port. In 1798 alone, 149 ships set sail for West Africa to pick up slaves. The profits to be had were huge, and Liverpool, which had been a small fishing village, was transformed into a boom town.
The slave trade made a very considerable difference to Liverpool's activities, and of course the trades that were associated with it. One has only got to look at something like the Town Hall, which was rebuilt in the late 18th century. And nearly all the contributors to that rebuilding would have been involved in the slave trade. One also sees it in some of the street names, which relate back to merchants who were trading in slaves. When slavery was abolished in 1834, the slaves of Cook got nothing. But the slave owners were compensated.
The removal of labour and the neglect of the land over 400 years of slavery had totally impoverished the continent of Africa. But that was not the end of European exploitation. From the 1850s, European powers progressively occupied and colonised the countries of Africa.
Throughout the colonial period was a period in which Europe looted Africa immensely of its cultural artifacts, of its technique, of human resources, of skills.
The colonialists designed an agricultural economy that would ensure a continuous supply of raw materials to Britain. But all the manufacturing was done in British factories. None of the profits came back to Africa. Many Africans argue that the colonization of Africa was only another form of domination after slavery formally ended. When African countries later gained their independence, they remained locked in the Western economic system. Today, much of that colonial economy remains. Most African countries are producing cash crops for which they have no use themselves, simply in order to earn money to pay off their debts to the West.
An average African country spends something like about 60 to 70% as of now of its foreign revenue in this debt servicing. Now, it just doesn't make sense, if you like, economically. Precisely at a time when the price of the goods and services, including the price of the commodities the Africans themselves grow, are actually dictated by financial houses in London, Paris, or Washington.
Perhaps the most insidious legacy of slavery is the devaluation of black men and women, which has resulted in a powerful racism. On the back of slavery, the myth of white racial superiority grew and even now is evident in our absence in any meaningful way from the history books. Slavery began a process of exploitation which continues today. The debate on reparations will make us aware of how this process can be brought to an end.
Well, that was Toye and Fanny Coyote reporting. Let's see what our audience here makes of the moral case. Bruce Collins, you're a historian from the University of Buckingham. Do you think that there is a moral debt?
Well, first, clearly, everybody condemns slavery and the slave trade. But I think it's extremely difficult to talk about a moral debt over generations.
But do you not accept Toyin's point that, at some level, Britain today has become what it is because of that history, and therefore one consequence is that Britain is inevitably entangled with history?
Well, we are, but I think from that particular film, there are two major things which I'd want to criticise. I think it's wholly wrong to suggest that slavery is somehow produced because of white demand for it. There was a massive and vigorous slave trade which went on before any Europeans had any impact on Western Africa, through sub-Saharan Africa across to the Red Sea
and, your other point?
And Eastern Africa.
And your other point?
As many slaves went eastwards to the Arab world as went westwards to the Caribbean.
OK, thank you.
That's the key.
OK, John Santamu.
There comes a point at which you say to yourself, Britain today is made up of people who are not all white. There are people who come from all over the places. It's multicultural, multi-ethnic. My daughter, who's been born here, I am Ugandan myself, is she really morally responsible for what happened to my ancestors, who in our case in East Africa, it is the Arabs that actually took a lot of slaves?
But to be precise, I think they're making the case about the British state, not about individual Britons. OK, John? Bernie Grant, you're one of the founders of the African reparations movement in the UK. How do you respond to this argument that you can't visit the sins of the fathers on today's Britain?
Well, I don't accept that, because I think that the film rightly says that people today are in the position they are because my ancestors were dragged thousands of miles across the Atlantic and died as a result of that. And when people talk about slavery, of course there was slavery. The Romans had Christians as slaves. They fed them to the lions and so on. But we're talking about a systematic system which deliberately took black people, no other people, black people from Africa to the Caribbean and exploited them there. And as a result of that, a lot of things that we know today stem from that, and that has to be corrected.
What do you think about this? What do you think about this question about moral debt? Who wants to come in on this?
I do.
You, sir.
Slaves in Africa and in parts of the Islamic countries had rights and had a certain choice of freedom.
But a slave is still a slave, isn't it? He or she is owned. End of story.
But what I'm saying is I hate people who try to make the excuse to excuse chattel slavery, what the Europeans did, as regards, oh, well, it was all right because it took place in Africa. And in Africa, it was a completely different system.
OK. Let me come to people who think, like Bruce Collins, that there isn't debt. Who wants to come in on that? You, sir.
I really think that the rich have a debt to help the poor. But it seems to me that this whole enterprise is a piece of political theatre based on extremely dubious history, on make-believe history.
We're going to come to the question of whether it's true or not. But
what needs to be pointed out is that what Europeans bought, Africans sold. We were shown in that film earlier on what powerful states there were in Africa. How did those fragile ships landing on the coast of Africa somehow round up these Africans and take them to the Americas? If my ancestors were slave traders, so were Bernie Grant's. So
all right,
were the developers.
There's the case against collaborators. Conley, what do you make of this case?
Well, I think the last remarks you've heard are painfully ridiculous. I mean, this happened, right? The living evidence is all around us. Mm. But I think my problem with the argument that's been presented is that the whole issue of slavery and how it informs the contemporary conditions of racism, both in terms of Africa and blacks in the metropolitan countries, is something that hasn't been explained.
That's helpful, because what I want to do is to move on to this question of the historical case. Is it true? What evidence is there that Africa was damaged by the slave trade? David Killingray.
rather difficult because you've got to untangle evidence that often isn't there. Clearly, the slave trade did impact upon parts of Africa with disastrous consequences. But most of the time, it's a trade that touches part of the coast of West Africa. There are large areas of Africa that are not touched at all by the external slave trade, either the Arab slave trade, which is important, or the European slave trade.
But what you're basically saying is most of Africa was not touched by this particular
Europeans intervention. Went there to trade, and they trade with Africans. They traded with Africans. It was a trade of mutual advantage. It was not solely a trade in slaves, it was a trade in other goods as well.
Okay.
This is not to minimise the impact that the slave trade had.
Okay, Herbert Ekweyekwe, you're a historian too, but I think you take a different view, don't you?
Well, definitely. Africa's population actually came to a halt in terms of any growth between the 16th century and the 20th century. It was just about 100 million in terms of population. Now, for anybody to argue, for instance, that there was a restriction in the coastal area shows quite clearly they don't know exactly what they're talking
about. Why did the population question matter particularly?
Well, very, very important. If we look at the age bracket of people who were removed, you're talking about 15 to 30-year-olds, the most important, the most active component of any particular kind of population. Let us also not forget that Africans continue to be very communitarian in terms of their family structure. So that what it actually meant was that it destroyed the very basis of Africa society.
All right. David Killingley, how do you respond to that?
I would dispute the impact over the whole of Africa. We also don't have the demographic data, which is vital if you're actually going to make a sustained case the demographic...
We've been through that. Berlin Champagny.
I think that the program is beginning to tell you, when you hear words like being dubious and people not having had any idea of the history, how much we need to educate people about the whole idea. I mean, for a start, 90% of the people in this country today don't know anything about the history. They have no idea. And so, therefore, if you start telling them about reparation, they don't know what you're talking about. Perhaps what we should be doing is identified to the white population that people, especially from the Caribbean, are happens to be their blood relations because of slavery. And rape started among slaves. My black foreparents were raped in the West Indies by European. And so we have the names of Marshalls, Brown, Smiths, Jones, McIntyres. We need to educate the people of this country that we are part of their system because of slavery.
Do you want to come back on that? Bruce Collins?
You started this. I don't disagree. I mean, I think we've got to see these things over. I mean, nobody's denying that slavery was the impact of slavery was extremely strong. It's a matter of how far you push it, and I think there's no escape from the argument that the African rulers, the warlords, the merchants were deeply involved in running the slave trade. Now, the Europeans were to blame for the slave trade, yes, but so were the African warlords and merchants. It was an extremely elaborate trade, and slaves were, I'm afraid, used also in West Africa for gold mining and gold panning as well. It was just as nasty.
Donna Kabara.
I mean, white people systematically humiliated Africans, and as Lurline has said, there was wholesale rape and there was wide scale. There's just massive theft. So there's how you can say there's no moral case to answer is beyond me. Where I would
I didn't what, I didn't say
right. The only point is that Africans were doing it as well. That's
another side. There's another side to this. Who benefited? Case being made over here that the Africans benefited as well.
Well, if you read The Economist, The Economist had an article which I read the other day saying you can't end the slave trade. It's so beneficial. Because it takes population from Africa and mans the plantation. What you must do is regulate the slave trade, just what they say now about the privatised utility. The slave trade is essential. And what really revealed, hearing three of our white colleagues speaking, how ignorant the British people are of the crimes committed in our area.
And still, I was just got 2 seconds left. Until we realise, until people are told that there was a slave trade not so long ago, and my grandfather was born in 1850, there were 4 million slaves in 1860. So don't tell us it was so long ago. It's within living. Paul Robeson's father was a slave.
Brazil, United States, and Sokoto in northern Nigeria.
Yeah, I'm just saying it's very doubtful whether it did any damage. It did if it happened to us the other way around.
I want people to deal with this question. Dorothy Kuya.
I think it's wrong to say reparations just in terms of the slave trade, because it's what happened afterwards. Africa was decimated, and it enabled Europeans to move in and colonise Africa.
Right.
So we have to take on the colonisation of Africa. All black people in this room are here in this country because either they... ancestors were enslaved or their countries were colonised. Yeah. My father was one of them.
Linda Bellos.
The provision of cheap materials on which people traded, got jobs, the growth of Birmingham as an industrial engineering base, these came directly out of the exploitation. The raw materials came from Africa. They were plundered, they were stolen. The food that created a better diet for working-class people still restricted. I'm not saying that I think that white working-class people had a wonderful time, because I think they were exploited by much the same people who were responsible for capitalism, and the same...
Okay.
You have to bring a class analysis.
That's all fair enough. That's all fair enough. I don't spend all our time in history. Who can talk to me about whether that's still persists, that effect still persists in today's world?
Well, of course it still persists, because when the slaves were supposed to have been freed, it was the slave masters that were compensated. In other words, they were getting more resources, whereas the Africans, whether they lived in Brazil or whether they lived in Africa, these resources have never been returned. We were talking about the collaboration of Africans in the slave trade. Of course, many of our ancestors collaborated, but they were given glass beads, they were given alcohol, they were given guns. These were destructive to African societies, whereas white people, Europeans, were given cotton, okay, gold, and all these commodities, which went to make the European economies of today.
All right, so that worked today.
That's a very patronising view about Africans, that they only accepted beads and baubles.
It may be patronising, but it's true.
It wasn't a trade.
It's not a question of whether it's patronising, it's whether it was true, and it is true.
Well, I don't think it is. Yes.
Howard Templey. There you are.
What I was going to say is that, I mean, relatively more Englishmen went to the Americas than West Africans. The West African population was actually growing during this period.
But the point is, they chose
as a result of crops brought in from the Americas.
But whether or not that's true, they chose to go. The Africans didn't.
But in a way, Britain paid its debt, or began paying its debt, after the slave trade was abolished by the suppression of the slave trade. And arguably, Britain spent more on suppressing the slave trade after 1807 than she had gained before 1807. Many British people died in suppressing the slave trade and trying to persuade Africans to give up the slave trade.
OK. I want to ask an economist, if I may. I'd like to ask an economist to tell me what he makes of this argument that the economic legacy persists. Joel Cabazo.
There is a danger of us blaming, say, for instance, the legacy of what's happened in Africa over the last 20 or 30 years purely on the effects of slavery and colonialism. Mm-hmm. We must sort of accept that the way the economies of Africa have gone is in large part due to the way they were managed. You know, I mean, for instance, 30 years ago when many of the African countries... 30 years ago when many of the African countries were sort of starting to gain independence, countries like Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand were well behind, say, Nigeria, Ghana. These are the figures. And yet, we look 30 years on, you see, you know, Africa's gone the other way. And, you know, so I'm saying that we mustn't blame everything on that. The legacy is there, but I'm saying that what about what's happening now?
You, sir.
I want to respond to the economic effects that we see today. I mean, when we watched the film, we saw that black people were taking over and they were encouraged to grow cash crops. Now, we still have that today. People from Ivory Coast and from Ghana, for example, they grow their cocoa. It takes them years to grow cocoa. But who dictates the price? is dictated in Britain or in the city or in Paris. Mm-hmm. And we see the same for sugarcane, all cash crops. These are crops that's not essential for black people in Africa. I mean, what's tea or coffee in the tropical climate? But it's necessary for Britain. And by doing that, we find out that the economic system in Africa is going down and down and down. The more cocoa they grow, the more coffee they grow, the less Britain pays, or the less Paris pays. Now, how come then, how is it possible then for African countries to repay their debt?
OK. I want to suspend the economic question for a moment, because there's another effect which has been advanced by the people who support African reparations, and that is that there has been a long-term psychological impact on African people. Femi Biko.
By and large, the attitude of black people has been damaged grossly with respect to their identity, their purpose and direction. So that the question of referring to, we speak in these terms as black people, we speak to black people. In truth, if I were to say Africans, it would be found problematic psychologically by most black people. Okay. Furthermore, slavery has, if you like, created a psychology of the oppressed.
Leah Chester, you are a member of the Nation of Islam, which stresses questions of black pride, reasserting black self-esteem. What do you make of this argument?
Well, first and foremost, I think for all those apologists for slavery and those people who are like today trying to justify slavery, I mean, it really compounds the reality that there is no morality in this country when it comes to black people, because the reality is that European people totally devastated Africa. The reality is that the legacy of that still exists today, and that we have such a thing in the world as genetic memory. And when you condition a man in a prison for 10 years, 15 years, and you call that man institutionalized, then you now go and have a look at 300 years of servitude slavery where people are destroyed as a human reality, and you have the audacity to sit here today and talk about this is not... You're trying to talk about one little part of Africa. The whole of Africa was destroyed, and all the black people today suffer from that legacy. That all of us today suffer the realities that we were destroyed as a people, having no right to read, to know, to have knowledge of our God, to have our own names, our language, our culture. This is the reality. And when you sit here today, this demonstrates that you have no concept of morality and that black people must get together and do something for ourselves.
All right, thank you. Kambi Tegedi, what do you make of this?
I think there's an internalised self-hatred among black people. The way, I mean, that self-hatred is perpetuated in the way we treat ourselves, the way our own personal respect, and the way we treat each other as a group. So I think we really need to question ourselves. I think slavery definitely lives on. And the way we think, the way we... Everything we do has a lot to do with slavery.
OK. I'm going to come to the lady in the middle here.
If you look at it legally, you've had a crime against humanity here.
That's right.
OK, there's been damage, there's been benefit, serious benefit by Europeans, OK? And Britain was at the forefront, and there should be a remedy.
Right. OK. I'm going to take a quick answer from that lady up there, if I may, on the back row over there.
Right. I think the discussion's a bit bizarre. I mean, I'm not traumatised, nor am I a victim of history. I think the problem, I think this discussion's quite indicative, really, of the whole kind of way we look at issues today. We're letting, you know, history dictate what we do today. And the question that we've got to face is, what is the most effective way of campaigning both against racism in Britain or what's going on in Africa today? And to do that, we've got to look at what's going on now. And I'd say the effective thing we can do is point to the barriers, both in Britain and in Africa, that people have to be able to take control of their lives. And if we're not, you know, this bunch of people who just want mass counselling, we're not exactly going to be the people who are going to be very useful to in that project.
All right, I know there are a lot of other people who want to come in, but there's a whole other area that we have to address in the time available. We've discussed the moral principle, but what about the practical dimension of all this? How could Britain compensate Africa? Here's Linda Bellos to outline the key demands being made by the African reparations movement.
At its conference in Abuja, Nigeria in 1993, the Organization of African Unity proposed an international campaign to demand reparations for the enslavement and conquest of Africa. The issue provides us with an opportunity to re-examine the myths and realities of a process that took over 400 years and cost millions of African lives. At the very least, we demand acknowledgement and an apology. The movement enables us to examine what it means to be of African origin, and finally, it provides us with an opportunity to be proud to be African. Some people have argued that it's unrealistic to expect compensation from Western governments or banks in the City of London. But the Africa reparations movement is not alone in thinking it does have a good case.
If you take the compensation the Germans have paid to some of the Jewish community following the Holocaust, if you take the claims now being made against the Japanese government by the so-called comfort women who were forced into prostitution, Korean women, in order to satisfy the demands of the Japanese army during the war, those claims are being made. So it's a perfectly legitimate thing to do. I suppose if you take it back more than a century, you're moving into a new timescale. But the argument is an absolutely valid one.
A very specific demand we're making is that objects stolen from Africa should be returned, such as the Stars of Africa, the world's largest diamonds and now part of the crown jewels. These were presented to Edward VII in 1907 by the illegal government of the Transvaal in South Africa. We want them back. We also want the huge collection of African art housed in Britain's museums, and don't accept the British Museum's defence that it is prevented by law from handing over anything.
I think if the Libyans, for example, organised a commando group to come and rob the crown jewels from the Tower of London and took them back to Tripoli, and then the Libyan Assembly and Colonel Gaddafi made a law that they should not be returned to Britain, the British would be up in arms and said, you know, we can't allow that. That's just not on. You know, that's not cricket or whatever they, you know, expression they use.
Works in the British Museum have been deemed to be curios rather than art. They are dated from the time of British acquisition. This, in our view, shows an absence of respect and objectivity.
In 1897, several hundred British people went to the Kingdom of Benin, massacred the population, and stole several thousand pieces of precious and sacred jewellery. If you today go to the Museum of Mankind in London, it doesn't describe any of that history. So we need to control these artifacts and get access to them so that we can tell the full history. We also need to control them as African people because they benefit British museums. They give praise and credit and they bring money to British museums, and they were acquired illegitimately, illegally, through acts of plunder and death.
It is not only in the museums that the true interpretations are missing. Education in Britain, for instance, constantly undervalues and denies Africa's contribution to the world and the damage done to it by Europeans. This must be changed.
I think we can benefit by challenging the representations of inferiority, by challenging the assumption that we are inferior. If white people are shown a range of the things that Africans have achieved, a range of African accomplishments, that we can begin to challenge some of their crude racism, some of their crude stereotypes.
The issue is not only of justice, it's about economics. We won administrative independence in the 1960s. Now we need full economic independence. We want the cancellation of so-called third world debt. We want to create an environment in which Africa and the Caribbean can be economically self-sufficient. And where we do trade internationally, we want fair prices set by Africa. A debt of over $200 billion rests on the shoulders of these workers and millions of others across Africa and the Caribbean. If these debts are to be cancelled, it is vital that the financial gains are shared equally by all African peoples, and not by corrupt dictators supported by the West.
If the Third World debt were cancelled in whole or in part, then the opportunity for benefits to accrue to those countries that are now being squeezed by these brutal bankers, standards rose, confidence would rise, and only a confident nation can deal with dictators.
These countries are not capable of paying their debt servicing and investing in education, in food production, and other essential things at the same time. If a country is forced to spend 85% or 90% or sometimes 100% of export income in servicing debts, then it does not have money to invest in education, in infrastructure, in food production, and other essential items of welfare.
Only a fool would say that we would forget the past or that we ought to forget the past. We live in the past at the present moment. I'm from Liverpool, and Liverpool built its wealth on the exploitation of African men and women. White people have convinced themselves and one another that they're superior, that black people in some way pollute them. That's why black people are denied jobs and opportunities, because after several hundred years of exploitation and convincing themselves that they're superior, they don't want anything to do with us.
The issue of reparations enable us as Africans to look critically at our past and positively towards our future, and to begin to repair much of the damage caused by our enslavement. We demand justice, not aid. We want to use money to invest in Africa. And finally, we want Africa's place in the world, in the New World Order, to be that of an equal.
Bernard Grant, what would be the point of an apology?
Well, I think an apology sets the historic record straight and allows people to believe in themselves and know that what happened to them was as a result of the wrongdoings of other people.
John Sentamu, does it matter to you?
Really, not really, because, you see, I am more interested in the reality of living in Britain today. Yeah. If the Queen apologised, for example, for the slavery, for the inhuman crime committed against African people through slavery, that might be good. But what I want to look at, OK, she might say those words. What's happening in terms of jobs, employment, opportunities, education? And so for me, if apology equals the doing away with racism, the country becoming more interested in social justice, equality, fairness, by all means, let her apologise.
Okay.
The practicalities of an apology, that is exactly what you want the nation who has suppressed you to do, to apologise, brush it under the carpet, forget about it, and say it didn't exist. That's not the way to tackle it. It needs to be
I think it goes further.
Okay. Education. Mr. Hargreaves.
I feel that practicality has got to be the base of it all. Who is going to apologise to whom? To whom, if you like. I don't see, to be honest, that an apology to every black person in the world is going to achieve very much to anybody.
Let me deal with this question of practicalities, which has been advanced. Principally the one that was raised in the film about return of artefacts.
I have no problem with returning artefacts. We can make replicas, and we can go and look at replicas. We can go and look at replicas in British museums of artefacts from anywhere in the world. Yes. I see a great point in artefacts being in the places where they were looted from.
Yeah.
I am concerned that they should be well looked after. And having worked in a number of African archives, I know that they are in a rather parlous state. But that's partly the economic question as well.
Okay, Maurice Davis.
I think there are many people in museums in Britain who are extremely uncomfortable with the things they now have in their collections. They're not happy about being the guardians of other people's heritage and other people's culture. But having said that, the whole mindset in museums is about keeping things forever in collections and making them available to everyone. So it's very difficult for people in museums to break through that mindset. Now, I think the solution is for people to talk. In America, there have been enormous and very productive discussions between the Native Americans and the museums that have led to very productive results. Okay. And I think people must start talking. It isn't a confrontation.
All right, Stephen Small, what about the way these artefacts are presented? Because if you accept that point, would that be a point that you're concerned about?
Okay, the reason why people in museums are concerned about whether others have access to these artefacts is a result and one of the legacies of slavery, which is white ignorance and arrogance and condescension. We have been organising in the African reparations movement to begin to document the artefacts that have been stolen. We know that there are stolen artefacts in the Horniman Museum, in the Museum of Mankind, in the Mayer Museum, in Liverpool. We have to begin to look at these artefacts, discuss with those who currently control them, and look at alternative ways in which the whole of society can have access to them. One of the ways in which one of the ways in which access can be created is by returning the artefacts to their rightful owners, whether in Africa or whether under the control of African people in Britain in an alternative repository.
All right. Let me just... I wanted to just pick up the point about ignorance and education. Dorothy Cuya.
I think there needs to be a change in what we teach children and how we teach them. And even how museums present the information about the objects they have. But you must remember that some of these objects, which are religious, cultural objects, actually need to be in a place of religion back in the countries of origin. They're not for viewing. And in fact, when we talk about sacrilege and religious times here, there's a lot of sacrilege being committed in terms of these objects. And children here need to understand that masks are not just objects that are funny things. They actually have a deep significance to many cultures, and that's not taught.
Okay. Linda, I just want to pick up one thing coming out of that from your film. How does this question of presentation of objects actually relate to the question of changes in education?
I think that the way in which these items are described by the British Museum in an early catalogue as curios, as exotic, is a way of degrading and insulting our culture and our community, of misunderstanding the significance. Only by returning them to the places in which they were created can the real relevance be seen. And I think that the British people as a whole, white people and black people, need to learn, and I think they will gain something.
But how does that happen, Linda? What actually takes place? I mean, how would you do it?
Well, has already been said about dialogue. No, certainly not. Certainly, we're not talking about doing anything unlawful. We are saying, first of all, there must be an acknowledgement that they were unlawfully acquired, and that is the case. We have got evidence that these things were stolen.
Okay, that's the first thing. Second thing.
Then we have to make sure that we have adequate resources for building museums with tourist sites next to them, so that we can have hordes of European tourists going to Africa to generate income, so they want to do their scholarship. We don't have to go to London. They come to Lagos.
That's perfect. Bernie Grant, very quickly.
Can I mention 2 points? My friend here said that the...
just very quickly.
Yes. The curators want to keep to preserve these things so everybody can see them. That's a fallacy, because the Fanti fishermen in Ghana can't go to the British Embassy and ask for a visa to come and see the Fanti flags in the British Museum. It's a nonsense.
All right, Bernie, I'm going to stop because I think we're missing... There's one important point which I think you'll all kill me if we don't deal with, and that is the question of schools and education, which I want to... Can I just come back to you, Stephen, on this question of schools? Stephen, what would a child that goes to school now learn, if you got your way, that he wouldn't or she wouldn't learn now?
A child who goes to school with a new system, a more comprehensive, inclusive system, would find out that the world did not begin with the English, the world does not end with the English, that Europe was created by Africa, that Europe continues to be created by the contributions of Africans, culturally, not just in terms of music and dance, but economically, educationally, socially.
All right. We only have a little time left, and I want to deal with what was the most, I guess, important part of this, and it's the economic aspect of this, the cancellation of debt. I want to take a contribution on the cancellation of debt. How would you do it, Linda Bellos? You didn't say in the film.
Well, how would I cancel debt?
Yeah.
Cancel it. We exert pressure. If there's a moral acknowledgement of the wrong done, then it would actually just be written off. That's the first thing. We need a transfer of money in some kind of symbolic recompense, because you couldn't pound for pound recompense African people. For even if we were paid a penny per hour for the labour that was exploited, that would bankrupt Europe. And I know some people think that they're doing a pretty good job doing it themselves, but I don't necessarily advocate it as a policy. We do need a transfer of sufficient resources to invest in Africa and the Caribbean so that we can diversify and be self-sufficient.
All right. Joe Cabazo.
I think that would be sort of wonderful in an ideal world. The thing is that most of the debt was taken over the last 30 years, and the people from whom that money was taken still demand it back. So what are you going to say to them? They say, we gave you $100 million. Please return it.
And Bill, there were Bill Peters, do you think it's practical? Bill Peters used to be the High Commissioner in Malawi, right?
Yes, I think so.
Do you think it's practical?
I think it is possible to make a perfectly practical system for doing this. What is needed is a package for each country which is a debtor. And this program has been worked out not just by white middle-class people living in this country, but by people in Africa as well. And you would take into account with each country the amount of debt, the capacity to pay, the amount already paid, the forms of economic management, and a whole lot of other things. You can't simply, if you're cutting debt, say this one will have so much debt cut and that one will not.
All right, I'm going to take some contributions to the audience. I'm going to ask you to keep them brief.
Thank you, sir, first. Thank you very much for the chance. Cancelling the debt in itself is a useless thing unless it's attached to a creation of a new economic mechanism of relationship between the South and the North. Because you cancel the debt today, after 5 years, the same debt will be there. The same exploitation will continue. So what we have to do is to make sure that there is an understanding in Western government institutions, Western governments, that not just are you going to say, yes, right, we excuse you of this debt, but that they are not going to exploit us anymore, they are not going to steal anymore.
Okay.
There has not been a break. We are still being colonized.
Go ahead.
The African continent is colonized today through finance institutions, the World Bank, the IMF, and the puppets they put in power in our African countries. And I think this is the core of the debate.
That's what I'm trying to get to. Okay, Peter Herbert.
The final point is, if European countries do not address this problem, it will rebound on them double fold.
That's right.
Because the unemployment here is linked to the poverty in Africa. If they keep us poor, if they keep us outside, then they themselves will suffer. So the Brandt Report, which has lied on the shelves and they've been ignored for years, has a message for the centuries to come. And they can either do something about it now, or they can live with the consequences under which we will all suffer.
Gentlemen up at the back here, in the red tie and the dark suit.
Can I say that I come from Rwanda to begin with, and I don't... that if Africans don't address this question now, you know what happened in Rwanda? We lost 1 million people, and we know it's a legacy of slavery and colonialism.
Okay.
If the question of reparations is not addressed today, we're going to see a repeat of Rwanda in the forthcoming years.
All right. Let me put to you, Tony Benn, a question which is difficult to ask, so I'll ask it. A lot of people, even in this room, wouldn't want to give money to some of the people who run state in Africa now. How do you get around that problem?
Adam Smith said the rich are the pensioners of the poor. Africa has got 20% of the world population and 2% of the world's income. And it is about exploitation. The BBC correspondent wrote an article the other day saying, you don't need governments in Africa, they should be taken over by companies, back to the slave trade, run by companies. And what we're witnessing, and nobody's touched on it much, is the triumph of capitalism.
Absolutely.
There are a billion people living in the world on less than a dollar a day, and the rich countries are getting richer and richer.
But tell me, a lot of the people who essentially are ruling as dictators in Africa are themselves arch-capitalists.
Do you want
to forgive debt to those people?
What do we do with the dictators? We sell them arms to repress their own people. We sell them arms. I mean, you don't have to get to the root of the matter. Slavery is a bit of exploitation.
Is there a way of relieving debt?
Yes, there is. And what's been happening with some countries over the last few years is that they've started addressing their own economies.
But would you impose conditions on these dictators?
Of course, absolutely. Without it, there would be no way forward.
I'm going to put one last question, if I may, because we've used the time, to Bernie Grant, as one of the founders of the ARM. Why is this the most important thing to be dealt with by black people in this country, given all the other things that we've been hearing about in the last couple of weeks, unemployment, police and so forth?
Because I think it's important for us to make sure that our history is correct. I think that our ancestors demand that the truth be written about what happened in the Middle Passage and what happened during colonization and enslavement, number one. Number two, I think it's important
for our young
people to be able to understand where they fit in the scheme of things.
But is it more important
at the
present time than their inability to get jobs, the treatment by the police and so forth?
I think that it is as important as that. And I think that at the background of all these other problems lie the relationships between Africa and what happened in enslavement and colonization and Europe and in Britain in particular. And unless we are able to crack that particular nut, all these other things, Joy Gardner, condoms, statements, etc., none of these things will be solved unless we're able to solve that fundamental difficulty.
All right. Thank you very much indeed. I'm sorry that I couldn't get you all in. That's all that we have time for tonight. Reparations to Africa, like all other radical options, is today at the margins of politics. But tomorrow, who knows? This debate could move to centre stage. Thank you all in the studio for your contributions again, and thank you at home for watching us. Good night.